our sixth author. We've covered three very important writers of the Romanticism, the pinnacle of romantic short stories, Hawthorne, Melville, and Edgar Allan Poe. And now we have a triumvirate of poets after dipping our feet and starting in an easier to grasp way with a Longfellow. Last week we had the opportunity to see the immense universe of Whitman, and I think it's fairly impossible to understand 19th century poetry without understanding Emily Dickinson. Dickinson and Whitman seem to go hand in hand. There is no way of understanding the poetry of Whitman without understanding the poetry of Dickinson, and vice versa. They both have a very strong duality. At the same time, curiously, I'm pretty convinced that neither knew about the other. Maybe Emily Dickinson had heard about Walt Whitman, but she received news that his work was scandalous and blasphemous, and decided never to read Walt Whitman. And it was very difficult to come to know Dickinson. This the quote we have for today: "This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me." Was never posted. So most of her work, 1,800 poems in total, were meant to be burned upon her death. But her sister Lavinia did not follow her deathbed wishes, and fortunately, they were saved for posterity. So Dickinson is a major figure. I would say that probably there is a great deal of consensus to name Dickinson the most important female author in American poetry. Some even consider her the greatest poet in American literature, and I think that's a more disputed seat. But without a doubt, she's up there. She's up there in the peak. Sharing very tight space up there with Whitman and other contemporary poets. It would be a matter of discussing which ones each of us select. But for sure, she's a pioneer. She's a pioneer for female literature, marking the path for women writers to follow, and with all the traits of successful feminism before feminism was invented. She has this point of eccentricity understood from the positive point of view of not wanting to follow the norm, of being eccentric versus concentric, looking for a path of her own rather than following the treaded path. Undoubtedly, she was autonomous, and she was rebellious. In this time that we're living, it's very easy to understand her situation. She lived a secluded life, a life of isolation, away from the people. We could say that she was practically quarantined for life, and it was very common in 19th century America for pregnant women to retire from society and stay home because there were so many nasty diseases that could affect an expecting mother, that sometimes they were secluded at home, and they lived in this isolation, this quarantine, to be able to give birth to a healthy child. It seems as if she had secluded herself to give birth to her poetry, which is a very poetic way of explaining her choice of life, of not living in the public and living in the family home for the majority of her life, and not searching the contact or the recognition. It seemed to, it seems when we know about Emily Dickinson's life, contrary to most of the other authors that we've read, and most of the authors that we know, maybe with the exception in English literature of Jane Austen, that, the reward was actually writing. It wasn't being published. She was happy herself, just, writing her poetry, and publishing it seemed to be a nuisance that she wasn't as willing to go through as would be the case for other authors that supported that possibility of failure. Whitman is a perfect example of authors that had to face failure many times before they had a go at success. And there are several things that I want to read from, and I think that it's time we start reading about her. To start, I'm going right before all the lockdown came in place, I took out a great deal of books that I wanted to use for the second semester for American literature. So I'm lucky to have at home most of the good books in the Central Library that are introductory for the authors that we have this course anyway. Since the loaning system doesn't work at UNED, they would just be on a shelf if I hadn't taken them out. I recommend you, if you want to extend your knowledge on Emily Dickinson, to make sure to have a look at this Cambridge Introduction to Emily Dickinson. If you've ever been to the UNED Central Library, philology and English books are on the fifth floor. This is in the section of American literature. There are several things that I like about this introduction. It hits on many keys that I think are very interesting. First of all, her personality. When we talk about her personality, there are so many adjectives that we can come up with, and all of these adjectives have a positive spin to them. She was funny. She was ironic. She was original. She was unusual. The Cambridge Introduction talks about Emily Dickinson, saying that Emily Dickinson was wickedly funny, fiercely loyal, and bravely original. Those three are great adjectives. The ones that I've used, I think I've coincidentally said some. I would say she's surprising. Regarding her influence to posterity, how important Emily Dickinson's legacy was for the rest of women writers. The introduction goes on to say in the next paragraph, Dickinson was a model for all women poets who followed. I would say all women poets, and in general all women artists, because she had all those traits of independence, of autonomy, of being rebellious, of looking for the new way of interpreting life, and not conforming with the tenets of society, which were so restrictive and so constraining for women. She seemed to live a life of liberation. Despite her fairness, her beauty, she remained single in life and not interested in pursuing a lot of the established lifestyle of a marriage, the established lifestyle of the patriarchal system of looking for an adequate future thanks to a prosperous husband, etc., etc. And all of her important relationships in her life had to do with women. So the important figures in her life, there is this triangle with her sister Lavinia and her sister-in-law, Susan Huddington. Her sister-in-law lived door to door with her, and despite living so close, we know so much about Emily Dickinson because one of the things that have reached our times are the enormous amount of letters that were exchanged between Emily Dickinson and Sue, Susan Huddington, someone that Emily knew as Sister Sue. She probably had a stronger relationship with Sue than with her brother, which has led to many speculation. But as in the case of Edgar Allan Poe, I'm just not going to extend too much on this conspirative theory style of speculation about elements of her life that remain as a mystery and have contributed to making her figure all the more interesting and more obscure and more mysterious. I think that's also the beauty of some of these authors, that we don't have enough knowledge about their life to openly criticize their mistakes in life. And we just admire the aura that is incomplete. Sometimes incomplete pictures are appreciated more than those that are full of details, and we can notice the differences and the mistakes in the painting. So I prefer this blurry image of Emily Dickinson, this daguerreotype style, like the one that the picture that we use for this unit, to have this Emily Dickinson that remains partly known, mostly unknown, and we have to come to conclusions about her life and her lifestyle through her poetry. And her poetry is very interesting because it's full of different literary personas, so it's even more elusive, more evasive. And that's also a key word that I would attribute to Emily Dickinson. She's elusive. She's someone that it's very difficult to come to a concrete conclusion about her. And this elusiveness also grants her an aura of ambiguity and mystery that I think is very appropriate that helps magnify her work even more, even though she really doesn't need it, because her work is just simply spectacular. Let me see. Regarding her sister-in-law that she called Sister Sue, they always talk about the most important friend in Dickinson's life is Susan Huntington Gilbert. Emily Dickinson and Susan Huntington Gilbert met when they were both teenagers. Susan shared Dickinson's love of literature, gardening, recipes, and nature, as well as her dislike of chores and household duties. Dickinson greatly trusted Susan, valuing her opinions and advice, and the two participated in an intense friendship that spanned 5 decades. Dickinson was eager for a personal connection to replace the friends who had married and moved away, and Susan, orphaned at a young age, was just as eager to become a part of a family. Of all the friends and relatives that Dickinson wrote to during her life, she wrote the most letters to her sister Sue. Eventually, Austin, Emily's brother, fell in love with Susan, and they were engaged in 1853. The young couple married in 1856 and moved into the Evergreens. Susan Dickinson was delighted to live so close to her friend. Interesting, even though she lived next door, Dickinson still sent Susan letters. That's an interesting passage of this part. Regarding Emily Dickinson's decease and why she became well known for the rest of the world when she had been absolutely anonymous during her lifetime. As you can see, as you can probably read between the lines in this passage, the life of Emily Dickinson and even the family circle seems to have been imbued by an ironic sense of life. Emily Dickinson grew up in a religious atmosphere, but it was a different type of religiousness. It reminds us to Benjamin Franklin's or to Emerson's style of religion. So if you have to look for a very, very bizarre connections from the religious point of view. Dickinson can be compared religiously to Franklin and to Emerson. What is coincidental about those three figures? They believed more in spirituality, the kind of self-made religion that I'm going to use a term afterwards that's in one of these books, homemade religion, rather than the Calvinist Puritan tradition that we're so used to. Remember, Dickinson experienced the Great Awakening, but belonging to a Unitarian family, they were not directly appealed by those ideas. Let me read. I think I only have one more passage selected about this. When Emily Dickinson passed away, the initials EED were carved upon Dickinson's headstone. However, in the early 20th century, Sue's daughter, Martha Dickinson Bianchi, chose a new tombstone. The new epitaph read simply, "Called Back." It's an ironic expression that I think that Emily Dickinson would have grinned if she had seen it. The phrase referred to Dickinson's last known letter, which he wrote to her cousins, Louise and Frances Norcross, written just a few weeks before her death. The letter read, "Little cousins, called back. Emily, L906, number 1046. Why are her poems expressed with such weird marks as a number and a reference? Because something that we're going to realize today is that Emily Dickinson is absolutely different to anything you've seen before in terms of poetry. Her poetry is so original, bizarre, and outlandish in terms of the tradition that we see, that she chose to create poetic rules that suited her ideas. There is capitalization, there is hyphenation in her poetry. There is an unusual choice of lines. There are no titles in her poems. So her poems are normally known by two traits, either the first verse or a number that has been assigned according to classification. And that's why we have numbers that span from 1 to 1800 that account for the different poems in her collection. Dickinson had read Hugh Conway's popular novella called Back and was playfully punning. So as you can see, she would joke about death. Death is one of the key elements in Emily Dickinson's work. We're going to see afterwards when we start seeing the contents of the slides that death is one of the revolving topics about that seem to obsess or at least entertain many hours and many lines of Emily Dickinson's work. It's about this inner world, and we come from the realm of a poet that was that had the aspiration of writing for the world, Walt Whitman wrote A Song of Myself, which was actually a song for the world. It was a song of everyone. It was a song with list of people that were being observed or addressed, that were being appealed. In the case of Emily Dickinson, these two lines say everything about this. This is the letter to the world that never wrote to me. She felt, I wouldn't say imprisoned, because it was absolutely voluntary, but she did not feel a connection, a direct relationship with the rest of the world. If you want to interrupt me in any moment, feel free. Just write your questions you might have down there. That's what I'm. I'm going to read the very last a paragraph of the first chapter of the introduction. After Emily Dickinson's death, Lavinia went through her sister's possession and found pages and pages of writing. They just expected to find a few things, and they found a ton of poems that had never seen the light. Some of them had never been shared with anyone. Far more than anyone knew existed. Several months after her death, the poems and letters that were Emily Dickinson's life's work began a new life of their own. So the poetry of Emily Dickinson began to be the poetry of the world the day that Emily Dickinson died. So this date that you see there 1886 is more relevant than ever, because that's when the world started to know that in America there had spun a genial a poet that alongside Walt Whitman, that was already an established poet, had been writing poems for the last 50 years, even though nobody had heard about her. So again, very interesting introduction to the topic. What was a problem with many of the poems that were written, that were published during her lifetime? Not many, probably less than a dozen. The problem with the poems is that the editors had an intrusive effect on her poems. Her poems, when they were published, were modified. Some words were substituted because they were considered awkward, or they were considered unnecessary. The punctuation was altered. The verse length was modified. Words were added. Words were subtracted. The general understanding of the people that served as editors of this Emily Dickinson that sent a few poems to different magazines and different journals and publications was that Emily Dickinson was simply not very talented. And since she could not reach the rhythmical purity of, for example, Longfellow, she had to recur to this hyphenation, to this awkward capitalization, to this verse length, when actually that was a trait of her own. She had invented that language of her own to express her work. Everything that I've said makes Emily Dickinson off the bat seem a bit imposing, as if it were going to be difficult to understand. And I think that Emily Dickinson has a natural talent. Emily Dickinson has an easy way of connecting with every reader. Every reader finds a poem by Emily Dickinson that makes them smile because they think it's either witty or ambiguous or entertaining, or it makes you think. Her poetry is accessible. It's easy. It's appealing. It's raw. It feels authentic because it's so different to everything that we've seen before. The hyphens are there to speed in the pace, and the same way that we have expansive poetry with Whitman that was not always very appreciated, we have the opposite with Emily Dickinson. We have a condensed type of poetry. Walt Whitman aspired to be the poet of the people, and his aspiration went unheralded for most of his life. Emily Dickinson has that natural talent of making her poems seem appealing, understandable, and elusive from the very first read. And not only that, all of her poetry looks unstable by definition. The different manuscripts, the different versions, they change words, they change lines, they change entire sections. Her poetry is always unconcluded. It's always in draft mode. There's indirection. There's a lot of ambiguity. You can come to a conclusion reading a poem by Emily Dickinson that is contrary to the one that another reader would come to. Even you can come to a conclusion reading one version of her poem and come to an absolutely different conclusion reading a modified version of the same poem. That is what makes Emily Dickinson's poetry so interesting and so special. I've been using in this introduction all of this information. Whitman and Dickinson have something in particular. Almost 150 years have passed since the bulk of their work saw the light. More than 150 years in the case of Walt Whitman, and they still remain something that is the golden standard of American poetry. Emily Dickinson continues to influence poets nowadays, and that's what's special about her. When we introduced Walt Whitman, we said that it was at last the promise that America had that America had always searched for, of making it new. Making it new turned into the motto of American modernism, of universal modernism, but especially American modernism. And the same way as the 19th century short story championed the world, 20th century poetry is going to champion the literary world. American poetry is going to become dominant in during the 20th century. The foundational stones of 20th century poetry are two stepping stones, Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman. That's why it's very important to understand one in connection to the other. Let me read from Puritanism to Postmodernism. You know, it's my favorite handbook introduce authors and to compare them, because I think it's what this book does the best. Section 5 of the end of part 2 in the book on page 172 reads as follows: "The proof of a poet is that his country absorbs him as affectionately as he has absorbed it." That's not a line by the authors of the book. It's a line by Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman wrote this in the early confident days of his 1855 preface, The First Leaves of Grass, only to find how long it would take before American public would actually absorb him. That absorption took a very long time to develop. It is one of the ironies of American literature that the later 19th century should produce two major poets who would prove to be genuine antecedents of the most serious modern American poetry. Yet, of these two, one should be a public poet who virtually lost the public he so confidently addressed, while the other was so private that scarcely any of her poems appeared in her own lifetime. Emily Dickinson so shunned public disclosure that most of her verses imply a total inwardness. What we were saying, exterior towards versus inward, a refusal to share in the collective utterance of the world. There is no ideal of chanting or talking here, rather a universe of rugged inward meditation and drama that takes on expression but no clear social form. The usefulness that Whitman saw in his poetry, the way of turning the American people literate in terms of poetry, was not something that Dickinson was especially interested in. However, both of them revolved around the idea of following Emerson. And it's very interesting to see how two authors that are so different, such as Whitman or Dickinson, find one of their major sources of inspiration in Emerson. And again, it's Emerson. I warned you at the beginning of the semester and at the end of the last one that Emerson was going to be an ever lurking figure of the second part of the course. Very important to understand and to come to the conclusion of how important his influence on an entire generation had been. Indeed, to set Whitman and Dickinson side by side seems almost a breach of propriety. Though one way of understanding modern American poetry is to say that many of its poets did just that. This quiet Emily Dickinson, a quiet resident of Amherst, Massachusetts, where there was a mix of Calvinism and Unitarian traditions, there was this combination of doubt and uncertainty, and her life is full of privacy and subtlety, where Whitman is so public and the book says garrulous. Her poems are so brief, tight, and oblique, where his expand, circle, ramble, and repeat, that many forget that they were contemporaries. Did they in any way know of each other? She was told his book was disgraceful and never read it. So Emily Dickinson was deprived of the opportunity of reading Whitman during her lifetime. He might just have known of her, but her letter to the world that never wrote to me, the quote that I've selected for today's class, was never really mailed. Seven of her poems appeared anonymously during her lifetime, but the remaining work, close to 1,800 of them, did not come to light until after her death. They were published in 1890, just before Whitman died. But it was not until the 1920s that they were fully acclaimed, and not until 1958, when Thomas H. Johnson edited them, that a satisfactory edition and full impression was possible. Only then was it fully clear that these enigmatic short lyrics were the work of America's greatest poet. So in the words of the authors of this work, Emily Dickinson can be considered by many the greatest American poet. Although she did now and again try to publish, for Dickinson the writing seemed a satisfying secret, sufficient in itself. The continent she sang was that of Emerson's inner self, and her vocation was the liberation of a private chicken coop, a phrase by Emerson. We know that she read Emerson and heard him lecture, and that he had some effect on her. So we can see that there is this combination. I have many more notes about Dickinson's self-enclosure, about her faith, about her style, about her hidden talent, the multifaceted Dickinson. But we only have an hour and a half, so I'm going to have to cut that short and not read from that book any longer. If you're interested in reading about Emily Dickinson, I can probably address you again. This is a book that I take out time and time again. I just read passages from it. I like it very much. It's called Beneath the American Renaissance. And it has most of the poets of the second semester. As you can see, the pictures are coincidental with the ones I use for the presentation. And chapter 14 is really interesting. Oh my God, I just closed the... Okay, yes, it's here. Page 387. It's called The American Women Renaissance and Emily Dickinson. The 1850s was a decade when American women's culture came of age, what might be regarded as the American women's renaissance. Most significantly, it was a period of the rapid maturation and earliest literary productivity of Emily Dickinson. Dickinson, arguably the greatest female poet, has not yet been discussed in terms of the social and literary flowering that occurred in women's culture during the 1850s. So at the same time as we're saying 1850 is this moment of concentration of romantic talent, remember that one of the big romantic figures, Nathaniel Hawthorne, wrote The Scarlet Letter, which is the first novel that has a woman as the main protagonist, a very intelligent woman, and probably did more for feminism than many similar works by women. Which is one of the steps of feminism. Books that have a feminist point of view, but that are written by men. And if you remember when you studied feminism, that's normally one of the earlier stages of literary feminism. Going back to what I said, this period of 1850 was the period of coming of age of American literature. We're going to have two more very, very important figures in American literature before the end of the semester, Harriet Beecher Stowe, which we should have already covered, but we haven't to allow you to complete the peck in time. Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote a book that that led the country, or that pushed the country closer to the Civil War, and at the end of the semester we're going to study Kate Chopin, an author that you're probably already familiar with because of Comentario de Textos Literarios en Lengua Inglesa, and Kate Chopin's importance is huge as well, not in her own time, and she goes hand in hand in this concealed lifestyle that Emily Dickinson led, and that only modern literary critics have been able to discover for future generations. Their contemporaries were not aware of writers such as Dickinson or Kate Chopin. When we go to the study guide where we start learning about the the different purposes that we have for this class. In this unit, we have five main tasks: learn, assess, apply, explore, and focus. Regarding learning, we're going to learn about the slow reception of her poetry. That has to do with her biography and understanding her biography, how she was very slow to be recognized, and sometimes she was not even considered to be a talented author during her lifetime by other poets. But how the 20th century has turned her into the major figure that she should have always been. We're going to see how Dickinson's life reminds us very much to it's a combination of Jane Austen and Anne Bradstreet in terms of leading a family life, and at the same time being a writer in the shadows, on the side of Jane Austen producing her work, but only for family consumption. We're going to see how her work is just brutal in terms of amount, 1,789 poems that were published over 100 years. There's a years missing there, after her death. We're going to embark in these in this close analysis to have a closer look at some of Emily Dickinson's poems. And if close reading is difficult in prose, it's practically fundamental in poetry, because it's the only way that we can come to any type of signification and see the formal features, how there's a trademark spelling style, the capitalization, punctuation, and lineation of her work, which is a bizarre and different to what we expect. We're going to see how Dickinson embarks in this indirection, which is poems that have no particular purpose besides expressing her inner self, and how she uses hyphenation in many cases to produce linguistic economy, this compressed style that is so famous in herself. In the last of the five purposes that we have for this class is to focus on Dickinson's originality, that seems to come from her visual power and technical skill to express her sensibility that has many facades, many sides, multifaceted. If we talk about her life, we have to start saying that she was born in Massachusetts, and again we're going to this this area of that is also that we also visited with Edgar Allan Poe. In that case, it was Boston. In this case, it's Amherst. In a Unitarian community. Remember that Unitarians are another mainstream religious style or following, different or even opposed in certain cases to Calvinism, and that is much more relaxed in terms of the expectations for the parishioners, the churchgoers, that every time we've seen a Unitarian in this course, we've seen that your Unitarian upbringing led them to have a personal interpretation of religion. Her life was almost secluded. She lived at home all day and barely went abroad, only for brief visits to her sister-in-law, or Sometimes she went into town, but her outdoor lifestyle was very, very limited. And she called herself, and she was called by others, a recluse by temperament and habit. I used a pun of pregnancy and quarantining before to express this a bit better. If we talk about the way she interacted with the world, it's basically through her poems and through her letters to friends and family, mostly to Susan, to Sister Sue. She attended a female seminary at a very young age, at the age of 9, but she only went there for 2 semesters. And after that, she was done with formal education, which does not mean that she was not an educated person. She was just self-educated in the way other writers have been, such as the case of, for example, Benjamin Franklin, or I don't remember if it's Hawthorne or Melville, Phyllis Wheatley for sure. Very little is known about her life, and that leads to a lot of speculation. The ways of coming to a conclusion about her personality and the way she expressed herself come through correspondence. Analyzing her correspondence also make us come to the conclusion that many of her narrative personas are just fabricated points of view, and there is not direct relationship, and this is an important factor. There is not a direct relationship between the narrator that is speaking in her poems and her own personal point of view. In the case of Walt Whitman, we see a direct connection and a direct expression of the poet's point of view and behavior, but not in the case of Emily Dickinson, where sometimes we see a range of ways of addressing the world and coming to doubts about the world. She seemed to want to remain secluded and away from the public eye. Her sister Lavinia found 900 poems of her a week after her death and requested her sister-in-law's help. A first volume, heavily amended, was finally published by Higginson's and An Enemy of Susan in 1890. That problem of introducing members that were not fully on the side of Lavinia and her sister-in-law created a tension and created 2 bodies of work that were in constant dispute until the 1920s. So the first editions of Emily Dickinson's poems were heavily amended, incomplete, segregated, depending on who the part of the poems belonged to, and that only found a solution when they were published later on by scholars and critics in the 1920s. We talked about the work of Johnson before. During her lifetime, she only published 7 poems, and all of them had an anonymous tone. The most relevant literary figure in her life was Higginson, in charge of publishing the first tome of her work upon her death. He was the literary editor of a very prestigious magazine that is still in publication now, and it's a weekly publication called the Atlantic Monthly. Sorry, weekly. I said weekly, monthly. I said weekly because the Atlantic has there are 2 major cultural magazines in America that persist and that have survived for over close to 150 years. One is the Atlantic Monthly, and the other one is the New Yorker. The New Yorker is a weekly magazine, whereas the Atlantic is a monthly magazine. She has gone to from an unknown status during her lifetime to achieving the highest positions of fame in American literature. Again, I'm going to ask you a question. At the beginning of the course, when you open the textbook and you had a look at the contents, you said, "Oh my God, I don't know any of these authors. What am I going to do to learn all of these authors that I have never heard about. Maybe you read and started John Smith. I know him because I've watched Pocahontas, but you were lost after that. From the first semester, practically, you've only come to a mild understanding of maybe a Benjamin Franklin beforehand. And you've gone to Alhambra and you've visited a souvenir shop. James Fenimore Cooper, if you were very interested in The Last of the Mohicans and you wanted to read the novelized version, and that's it. And from the second semester, we would say, well, I mean, I know Moby Dick. I don't remember exactly who wrote it, but I know Moby Dick. Edgar Allan Poe for sure. Mark Twain. Maybe Henry James. And Emily Dickinson. Emily Dickinson is much more important than in terms of universal reputation than Walt Whitman. That's a fact. Why? Because she's easier to read. Because she has this concept that we all have, that it's a straightforward poetry. Let me tell you the first time I rented a house, they had like five or six books that they left behind, and one of the books that they left behind was basically a book of selected poems of Emily Dickinson that I picked up, and it was very entertaining while I was waiting for the first days to get the furniture home and start doing some house repairs and housework. But as you can see, there's everybody's been exposed to this type of poetry, and this edition, Every Man's Poetry, it's very appropriate because there are very few authors that are more for everybody, for the young and for the old, such as Dickinson. We're going to read several of her poems in today's class. What you have to understand is, even though her poetry relies on the first person, it's not exactly a literary eye. She does write in the first person, but that eye doesn't represent her in all the cases. Okay. I already talked about her rise to fame in the 20th century, along with Walt Whitman. They have become the paradigms of romantic poetry, even though I think they're more proto-modern than they are late romantics, and they're considered the best poets of the 19th century. I've already talked about the volume of her work. Her period of greatest productivity spanned during 6 years, from 1859 to 1865, where she wrote over 1,000 poems. So that means that more of half of her work was written over the span of 6 years. In 1 year alone, in 1863, she wrote 300 of those poems. The 20th century, the early 20th century, editions were finally respectful with her style, what we talked about before, her punctuation, her selection of words, her verse length that seems to elude and escape from the principles or the habits of the time, and her the bold use of capitalization and hyphenation. I think that those are what makes her poems especially unique. In terms of style, her poems remind us to, if you're studying English literature, you've probably already heard about the metaphysical poets. If you haven't, you will. And her poems are a metaphysical distillation of situations. And they're not always referring to herself. She reflects about the life of a rifle, the life of a dying person, what it must be like to be buried and to live through eternity, if living through can be used as a verb in this case, probably cannot. She was a poet of a great deal of wit. And I think I've already mentioned this. There are very harsh reflections on death. And I think this is really important, how she focuses nature, because from the point of view of nature, she's also, I already said, from the poetic point of view, she represents modernism. From the nature point of view, she has two positions. In one, she's extremely transcendentalist. In the other, talks about poetry. About nature, in an appalling manner. And this appalling way of referring to the nature reminds us very much to realism. So, she lived in between three literary movements with all naturality. She was romantically transcendental. She was stylishly modernist. And she was respectful towards the brutality and the enormity of nature in a way that reminds us to the realists, to the realist movement. Her legacy never looked backwards, but always had a fresh and new start kind of look, and is an anticipation of what modernism was to bring. Her work is the indirection of her work defies any type of authoritative interpretation. It's very difficult to come to a conclusion about her work because it's intentionally multifaceted and intentionally complicated in its own conception. Rather than trying to assert her authority as a poet, she tended to question authority itself, which is a very interesting way of confronting a poetry from the point of view of a woman, and this is what makes her so have this aura of being a rebellious proto-feminist or pioneering feminist. Emily Dickinson's poetry lies in a middle ground that is never close to either doubt or to absolute doubt about everything or absolute certainty. She lived in that middle ground, and her works sometimes present many versions and many different possibilities, some more satisfactory towards looking for a final answer, some more open to interpretation and ambiguity. She didn't seem to not believe in any final answers to the great questions of life. Instead of favoring the straightforwardness of one single interpretation, one single way of looking at the world, she had a preference for indirection. Do you have to leave? Okay, don't worry, leave. Are you taking the charger? Yeah, my daughter's in the background. She's trying to do her homework. Okay, so regarding religion, yeah, you know, these things happen these days. It's going to be many kids appearing in the background of these web conferences. She was skeptical about religion, yet there is a spirituality in her style that makes religion a key component. So at the same time as there is no religious interpretation, there is a religious touch to her work. She doesn't seem to be extremely religious, but she doesn't seem to be openly atheist or agnostic even. There seems to be like a religious, underlying layer of respect, at least for spirituality and for this particular way of seeing the world through the eyes of a god or a creator. Style. If we have to refer to style, compact, brief, sharp, compressed. I like those four words too, because they're very concrete. Compact, brief, sharp, and compressed. Economy of language. We're going to see, an unprecedented economy of language in her style of writing and referring. Her themes seem to be revolving over the idea of life and death and immortality. What does she use as a way? Sometimes she recurs to rhyming. Sometimes she doesn't. Sometimes she uses consonants. Sometimes she uses assonance. She has a tendency to recurring to alliteration. There is a great deal of symbols and metaphors in her work, and analogies are sometimes used, but they don't have to appear all at the same time. She seems to use formal features whenever they're convenient. There is not a necessity to compress or to bring to the table the specific literary devices that we saw in other more canonical writers that follow the rules and follow the tenets of traditional poetry, the Bradstreets, Wheatleys, or Longfellows that we've read before. The idea of his poetry seems to go in a different direction, where literary devices are not the core of the analysis, but the message itself, the underlying message itself. Very aligned with the ideas of modernists. You have a comparing and contrasting exercise in your PEC, and I'm giving you very useful information here. I took this from a University of Illinois lecture, and I think it's a very nice way of contrasting Dickinson and Whitman. While Whitman was working class or addressed the working class and wanted the working class to read poetry, Dickinson thinks and breathes the air of the upper class, of this elite America that lives in the colonies and in New England and comes from religious families that have dominated the country for generations. While Whitman has public concerns, Dickinson looks inward and has private concerns. Whitman is an extroverted, what we read before, garrulous persona, open and embracing. Dickinson is introverted, shy, and concealed within herself. Whitman is boastful and shows an exhibitionist style, whereas Dickinson seems inhibited and does not even dare to publish during her lifetime. Whitman believed in writing about anything, writing about, for example, democracy. Dickinson was only worried in the individual, in the life at home, in the life of herself, of her family. Whitman is transcendental for certain aspects, and Dickinson is Puritan for some others. I would say that we could probably also flip these ideas, because actually Dickinson was not Puritan herself and her family either. She belonged to a Unitarian background, but it is true that Unitarians and Puritans lived in the same communities, and they shared space. So even though Dickinson is not purely Puritan, Whitman is not transcendental either all the time. He tends to be more transcendental in the way transcendental is understood by the transcendentalist in a more canonical way. But we see that sometimes he goes down to the detail and it exceeds that framework of transcendentalism. Whitman believes in the open form and the free verse. Dickinson believes in the closed form, and something that sounds like if it was a religious hymn. Whitman's poems are expansive. Dickinson's poems are compressed. Whitman writes in an epic style. Dickinson writes in a lyric style. Whitman is accessible, and I'm contradicting myself in a certain way, but that's why we compare and contrast authors, because I can say Widman becomes accessible when you understand him. But at the beginning, maybe he's not so easy to understand, and it's a bit more confusing to follow Widman's change and constant back and forth with styles, with length, with ways of expressing himself. Dickinson was accessible from the point of view of being appealing to many contemporary readers, but in her time, she was inaccessible and she was considered awkward and surprising, let's say even eccentric. So her inaccessibility seems to do with the understanding of her own lifetime. Widman believed that poetry had to be political, and Dickinson explored the psychological facets of poetry. For Widman, poetry was a way to affirm life. For Dickinson, it was a way of writing about death and immortality. For Widman, poetry had to be a relaxed, inviting way of attracting the reader. In Dickinson, writing was a way of expressing in a frenetic manner the forbidden thoughts that would not be uttered in public. So those are some of the ideas that you can take away as way of contrasting both poets. Thank you very much, Constance. I'm glad you like it. The presentation's already uploaded to the environment, so you can see it. We have, I think it's 5 poems, 6 poems. Let me see. Here. One, two, three, four, five, six. Okay, so we have 6 poems, and we're doing very well on time. We have around 5 minutes for each of the poems. So maybe we can read the poem and come to some conclusions about them. I'm going to use Professor Gibert's textbook. Mine is a bit different from yours, but the paging is exactly the same, page 383. This is my letter to the world. This brief poem, written in the spring of 1863, is often presented as an introduction to all of Dickinson's work, in spite of the fact that it is among her earliest verse. The habit of starting with these lines originated in the first volume of her poems, 1890, where the editors printed a regularized version of this little piece and turned it into a sort of prelude when they chose to place it on an unnumbered page, just after the table of contents and before the first page of poems. Although the author had given no indication that she intended it as any kind of preface, for she included it in fascicle 24, sharing a page with another poem, with part of another poem, it seems convenient to approach her complex poetry with a simple lyric that had moved so many of her admirers over the years. Its minor status within the Dickinson canon is no obstacle for readers to respond to the humble appeal of the speaker, who sends to the world her letter poem containing a message that comes from nature. Concerning form, this poem clearly exemplifies how Dickinson adapted to her purpose the congressional hymns she often sang. So her church going was her training ground for thinking about poems. She used a traditional hymn meter, which consisted in quatrains of alternating iambic tetrameter and iambic trimeter lines. That is, stanzas of 4 lines in alternate lines of 8 syllables, 4 metrical feet, and 6 syllables, 3 metrical feet. But she interrupted this regularity by occasional changes in the meters, as in line 5, which only has 7 syllables, and rhyme, as in lines 5 and 7. So this poem goes as follows. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. The simple news that nature told with tender majesty. Her message is committed to hands I cannot see. For love of her sweet countrymen, judge tenderly of me. As you can see, it's really interesting to see how she recurs. Let me see if I can see where is my... I don't know if the It's working. Ah, it's not. It wasn't on. Okay. What's interesting about this poem is both the capitalization, almost as if she was writing in German, where nouns are capitalized. Well, every line starts with capital, with capitals, and she seems to have a likening for capitalizing pronouns and capitalizing nouns and certain adjectives that she finds significant or interesting. And these hyphens are also another one of those trademark traits by Emily Dickinson. Okay, so this is the example of one of her poems. In the next poem, Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers, I think we're going to read two versions, because the difference is significant between one and the other. There's an 1859 version and an 1861 version. Are they the same? As you can see, they're very different. The beginning is the same, but the poem goes in absolutely different directions. Safe in Their Alabaster Chamber. The complex textual history of this poem can be partly explained in the context of the and her sister-in-law. As you can see, Emily Dickinson wrote several versions of her poems, and her poem characterized by a finished look. They were always open to modifications and alternative versions, such as in this case, maybe because she was advised from the people wasn't convinced with the final product. Susan praised the first stanza and advised the author to treat it as a complete poem, which she found deeply moving. I always go to the fire and get warm after thinking of it, but I never can again. To Susan's criticism of the second stanza, the poet responded with an entirely new one, slightly changing line 4 of the first stanza. But as Susan liked the second stanza less than the earlier one, the author wrote 2 more versions. At present, there are 5 manuscripts of the poem, and 1 or 2 more have been lost. The first version of the poem, dated 1859, was published in the Amherst local newspaper, the Springfield Daily Republican, 1st of March, 1862, where it was curiously dated Pelham Hill, June 1861, and the sleeping was added. So the editors would do that. They would add titles to her poems and a change of punctuation. Furthermore, punctuation was altered, as I anticipated. Capital letters were eliminated, and the poet's divisions into lines was also changed. After its publication, her introductory letter to Hinson, the second version of this poem was among the 4 pieces that she 1890 volume of poems. Todd and Higginson published it as a 3-stanza poem, arranging its lines in 3 quatrains. That is, they combined the first stanza with the 2 versions of the second one. Johnson treated it as a 2-stanza poem in 2 versions, probably because there is no holograph evidence of the poet's wish to blend the 3 different stanzas. Apart from changes in capitalization, the most important remodeling in the first stanza took place when the author replaced the first word of the 4th line, sleep, by lie, thus transferring the focus from the notion of slumber into that of stasis. The substitution was consistent with the content of each of the 2 versions. You will see that now. Indeed, the earlier version focuses on the marked contrast between the somnolence of the dead and the vitality of the birds and the bees. On the other hand, the later version emphasizes how the universe remains in never-ending motion while the dead are motionless in their graves. The opening unvoiced S sounds is the key note of the first stanza. The S of silence that strikes again in sleep, satin, and stone. As you can see, there is a alliterative touch to the beginning of the words. The various levels of imagery are among the most interesting features of this open-ended poem, which has been interpreted in opposite ways. Some readers have understood it as the expression of the author's belief in the resurrection, whereas others insisted that it transgresses conventional pieties and gives no consolation or hope because its conclusion implies that it is the physical world rather than the spiritual counterpart that continues to exist. Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, sleep the meek members of resurrection, rafters of satin and rafters of stone. Light laughs the breeze in her castle above them, babbles the bee in a stolid year, pipe the sweet birds in ignorant cadence. Ah, what sagacity perished here. So as you can see, there's a huge contrast between the gravity of the dead that are awaiting resurrection and the allusion to birds and bees and even like a spring style of image that comes to one's mind of bees buzzing around and birds enjoying the flowers around them, in contrast to what happens in the alabaster chambers. If we read the second version, we don't come to the same conclusion. Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, lie, not sleep, the meek members of the resurrection, rafter of satin and roof of stone. Grand go the years in the crescent above them. Worlds scoop their arcs and firmaments row. Diadems drops and dodges surrender, soundless as dots on a disk of snow. As you can see, this one has a more universal style and maybe elusive, and it's more difficult to come to particular conclusions about the second second version than the first one presented here. In the third poem, I taste a liquor I never brewed. It's interesting. Because it talks about a sort of alcoholic idea. I taste a liquor never brewed is a much admired poem, first published anonymously in the Springfield Daily Republican on May the 4th, 1861, under the title The May Wine, with editorial changes intended to please a conventional audience. Two lines were altered to get an exact rhyme, and one line was transformed for the sake of a more understandable metaphor. As you can see, they would do all sorts of criminal actions to her poems. For quite a long time, readers interpreted I Taste a Liquor Never Brewed as an innocent nature poem about the intoxicating joy that the author experiences when she is overwhelmed by the beauty of the spring scenery. The air is compared to liquor, and the speaker, like a bird drinking nectar, surpasses butterflies and bees in her capacity to luxuriate in sensuous pleasure. Nature as a source of delight is indeed a theme that recurs in many of Dickinson's poems, and in this sense, this particular one is no exception. What is unique here is a subversive aspect that is revealed when its last stanza is compared with the lines that inspired it. The doom of day, the divine Michael Wigglesworth had depicted the terrifying scene of the second coming of Christ, when the past over rush and to their windows run, viewing this light which shines more bright than does the noonday sun. In Dickinson's poem, it is also the saints who to the windows run, though not to contemplate the glory of God, but to see the little tippler leaning against the sun. Other literary sources for this poem have been found in Keats and Thoreau, though the most obvious one can be traced to Emerson, both in his poem Bacchus and in his essay, The Poet. Here, Dickinson seems to evoke some kinds of transcendental experience similar to the ones described by Emerson, whose general influence on her thought is undeniable. But again, what is original in Dickinson's poem, and rather unexpected from someone with her upbringing, is how wittingly she plays with the language of alcohol and inebriation to create an extended metaphor suffused with humor. She breaks some invisible barriers that might not seem very strong in our times, which were unsurmountable for women in that time, and she just seems to hop over them and successfully. Regarding meter, this piece is written in quatrains, alternating iambic tetrameter and trimeter with rhymes of various styles between the second and fourth line of each stanza. Two of them end with exclamation marks, which are uncommon in Dickinson's poetry, and here aptly emphasize the celebration tone that pervades the whole poem. I taste a liquor never brewed. I taste a liquor never brewed from tankers cooped in pearl. Not all the Frankfurt berries yield such an alcohol. You can probably understand that pearl and alcohol had a more similar pronunciation than they do nowadays. Inebriate of air am I, and debauchee of dew. Reeling through endless summer days from inns of molten blue. When landlords turn the drunken bee out of the foxglove's door, when butterflies renounce their drams, I shall but drink the more. Till seraphs swing their snowy hats and saints to windows run to see the little tippler leaning against the sun. Okay? So as you can see again, capitalizations, the hyphens, for example, in the second to last line, and saints to windows run. It's a way of not having to create the full sentence and also allowing the reader to quickly or swiftly read by. In I Felt a Funeral in My Brain, the following poem, also one of the most famous poems by the author. I think the three last ones are probably some of her most famous poems because of the opening lines that are so potent. According to Ralph W. Franklin, this poem was written sometime in the summer of 1862 in Fascicle 16, the only manuscript that is extant. And it was first published in Poems, 1896, without the last stanza. The removal of the terrifying last stanza had a significant effect on the meaning of the poem, which not only becomes less frightening, but may be interpreted as a discourse on death, rather than as the description of a psychic breakdown. In several poems of the same volume, Mabel Todd deleted stanzas illustrating the theme of the descent into madness because she feared they would upset readers. But there was an additional reason for Todd's editorial decision. Since she had grouped Dickinson's poems in four categories, life, love, nature, and time and eternity, by omitting the last stanza of this one, she could easily fit the altered poem within the last category. The poem is not about actual death in a biological sense, but about the death of consciousness, which is linked to the experience of depression. The semantic oddness of the first line makes it clear that the poet is working on a figurative level because nobody can literally feel a funeral in the brain. It is the feeling of a funeral that occurs in the speaker's brain while experiencing a disturbed mental state. The articulated ceremony of the funeral serves both to exteriorize and to give structure to a process that is internal and chaotic because it leads to a disruption of rationality. The ritual described in the first four stanzas is familiar. The mourners tread to and fro as they pay their respect. A church service is conducted. The pallbearers carry the casket to the graveyard and place it on a plank laid across the grave, while in the belfry, the bells tolls in monotonous knell. But then in the fifth stanza, something unexpected happens. The plank suddenly breaks, and the coffin, instead of being lowered on ropes into the ground, drops down, bumping against the sides of the deep grave, until it comes to a halt in the darkness of the bottom. The extended metaphor of the funeral illustrates a mental process that is characterized by monotony and repetitiveness, conveyed by the sense of hearing. The steps of the mourners and pallbearers, the drum and the bell, although the world of sound predominates, a special setting of the poem, which is suggested by the claustrophobic environment of the funeral, is also important. In his gloomy atmosphere, the mind becomes numb. The last line of the fourth stanza, wrecked, solitary here, draws the reader's attention to a different setting, that of an alien land where a shipwrecked mariner endures a solitude compared to that of the corpse in a coffin. But instead of expanding on this new metaphor, the poet returns to the funeral and suddenly introduces a final element of surprise. When a plank of reason breaks, the speaker plunges into an abyss of unknowing, swept up in a vacuum of chaos. Okay, so I'm not going to continue reading because I'm afraid that I won't have time to read the two last ones. You can read that last paragraph. I felt a funeral in my brain. I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading, till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift the box and creak across my soul with some boots of lead again, and space began to toll. Where is lead before? I thought I had seen lead before. As all the heavens were a bell, and being but an ear, and I and silence some strange race, wrecked solitary here. As you can see, and being but an ear, you can express more with less. If you were inside a coffin, you would be able to do nothing except hear what's happening around you. And then a plank in reason broke. That's those two words, in reason. And because it stops being literal and it starts being metaphoric. And there's an extended metaphor, therefore. We said that that it is not usual for her to recur to metaphors and symbols and assonance or consonants. But in this case, she does use a full-fledged extended metaphor for the entire poem. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down and hit the world at every plunge and finished knowing then. Finished knowing. It's like I stopped having reason. I stopped being a person connected to the world. The plank in reason. I think it's really powerful ending. I'm going to go for the last two poems. I think that one of you has already left the class. Oh, we're very pressed by time. I'm going to just read the poems. I'm going to leave you the analysis because we're 1 minute away from class, and you probably have another class that's starting in a few minutes. So I'm going to very quickly go over that. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last onset when the king be witnessed in the room. If you think about a fly buzzing around when you die, it's a disturbing image of being a fly, the last thing that you see between you and the light. And if it gets in the middle, it sounds terrible. I willed my keepsakes. It's like I gave my possessions away. Signed away what portion of me be. Assignable, and then it was. There interposed a fly. With blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows fail. The windows could be the eyes, for example. And then I could not see to see. So this one is disturbing because this idea of a fly buzzing around you being the last thing you see before you die. And the very last poem that we have for this unit, my life had stood a loaded gun. I want you to think about the narrative persona being, for example, a rifle, is one of the interpretations of this poem. Being a rifle, think of the whole poem as if it was read by a rifle or expressed by a rifle, a gun. My life has stood a loaded gun in corners. That's where you leave a rifle. Till a day, the owner passed, identified, and carried me away. And now we roam in sovereign woods, and now we hunt the doe. The doe is a female deer. And every time I speak for him, how would a gun speak? The mountain straight reply. So there's like an echo from the mountains. And do I smile such cordial light upon the valley glow? It is as a Vesuvian face had let its pleasures through. The Vesuvius, you know, it's a famous volcano. And when at night our good day done, I guard my master's head. 'Tis better than the adder's duck, the pillow to have shared. To foe of his, I'm deadly foe. So that reinforces the idea of a gun. None stir the second time. There's no second time for everybody that the loaded gun speaks for them, or speaks in front of them. On whom I lay a yellow eye or unemphatic thumb. That can be the thumb which you use to trigger. Though I thought then he may longer live, he longer must than I. That can be the owner instead of a divine interpretation. For I have but the power to kill without the power to die. So all of this reinforces the idea that she's personifying, she's using personification here in this poem to talk about a rifle in itself. So I hope this served as a solid introductory hour and a half for you to come to your own conclusions about Emily Dickinson and come to appreciate her as much as I think she deserves, and also to be better prepared for what lies ahead of you with a PEC. Remember that you can ask me any questions related to the PEC. I answered one in the forum. If you have any questions, just use that thread, because that way it's useful and everybody can benefit from your thoughts and also from the answers. I'm looking forward to talking to you again soon. It's been great to have you. I enjoyed more last week when you were more participative and made me and kept me on my toes, asking me questions all the time. So feel free to ask questions. Jesus, thank you very much for coming. It's great to read the names of many of you, the more faithful, Elena, Carlos, Constance, Fatima, everybody. Thank you very much. And I hope you find some time next week, César, to come to class, okay? You can interrupt as many times as you want, Constance. Thanks a lot. It's been great to have you in class again. See you next week.